Путинизм – это консолидация нации. Путинизм – это война. Это наступление на свободу.
Потому что все-таки Путин…
Что такое путинизм?
Domestic violence is in and atheism is out. In Vladimir Putin's Russia, you can now face harsher criminal penalties for questioning the existence of God or insulting someone's religious beliefs than for wife beating. Recent legislation decriminalizing domestic violence, as well as older laws outlawing blasphemy and so-called gay propaganda, are just a few examples of the Kremlin's ultra-conservative turn during Putin's third term in the Kremlin. But the Kremlin's hard right turn in recent years isn't just about domestic politics. It's also a key element in Russia's foreign policy. The Putin regime's embrace of what it calls traditional Christian values at home, combined with its support of far-right, xenophobic, and Eurosceptic forces abroad, are components of an incipient ideology aimed at shoring up domestic support, undermining Western liberalism, and restoring Russia's status as a great power. Meet the new Putinism. It's different from the old Putinism. And today, we'll take a closer look at this emerging ideology. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome back, Mark. I hope you had a pleasant flight from Big Bad New York and that your jet lag isn't too rough.
Well, at least I'll have an excuse for any verbal or conceptual incoherence this time.
And you're always so incoherent, so I guess we'll... Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. Welcome back, Sean. I hope you're not jet-lagged, too.
No, I have no jet lag.
Good. That's good, because I don't know if I can... I don't know if I could deal with two guests with jet lag. A common refrain in the ongoing conflict between Russia and the West is that, unlike the Cold War, it lacked an ideological component. I would submit, however, that this is changing, and changing rather fast. While Putin's Russia doesn't have a fully baked teleological ideology like the Soviet Union had in Marxism-Leninism, I would argue that the contours of an incipient and emerging ideology are beginning to come into focus. At the heart of this ideology is the notion that Russia has a specific historical mission as the last bastion of traditional Christian values that have been abandoned by the West. That a strong paternalistic state and assertive foreign policy is necessary to defend these values at home and abroad. Moreover, the Russia in this historical mission is not limited to the borders of the Russian Federation, but includes what the Kremlin calls the Russian world, or Ruskiy Mir. In many ways, this harkens back to the orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality of Tsar Nicholas I. It also draws on the thinking of white Russian emigre philosophers of the early 20th century, like Ivan Ilyin. And in an era when anti-establishment populism is on the rise in the West, the new Putinism provides the Kremlin with a useful wedge issue to advance its interests. Mark, 9 out of 10 doctors recommend that saying intelligent things is the best cure for jet lag. That's not really true. I just made that up. But anyway, so have at it. Is an ideology coming into focus here?
Well, I don't think I would put it in those terms. Look, I talk about a more ideological Putin these days.
I get this idea from you. So,
well, I mean, in the sense of comparing him with the essentially pragmatic Putin that we saw in his first two presidential terms, in which he spoke the language of nationalism, but when it came down to it, he was actually really much more of a realpolitik figure. And we do see now a Putin that definitely has, shall we say, a vision of the kind of Russia. And yes, a lot of these themes, as you've said, grand historical themes that are hardly novel, we see cropping up. But I do very much feel that this is essentially cherry-picked, and it's more of a sense of wanting to look at rationales for what he actually wants to create. Because I think this is, for me, one of the key things. And I take your point that this is not a sort of fully spelled out ideology like the Soviet Union. There is no Putinism.
There's no teleology.
Yeah, and there is no one book. There is no sort of short course.
Nash Zadache by Ivan Ilyin, I would we
can come back to Ilyin, because I know we've got some different perspectives there. But I think for me, if it's going to be a real ideology, first of all, there has to be some sense that it is indeed consistent. And in fact, I mean, I think there is striking inconsistency, whether we're talking about how it's applied at home or abroad. And secondly, it has to be constraining. It's easy to follow an ideology when it's basically providing an excuse for doing the things that you want to do anyway. The real test of whether it's an ideology is whether it stops you from doing things you'd like to do in the name of the ideology. And that I don't actually see. I see that sort of it's something that is proclaimed from the metaphorical pulpits and sometimes the actual pulpits, but in no way does it actually define the way that Putin and those closest to him actually act.
Now, what I see laws being passed at home that can only be described as retrograde. I mean, we're talking about outlawing, for all intents and purposes, blasphemy, outlawing what the Kremlin calls gay propaganda, decriminalizing, in the name of traditional values, domestic violence. The whole Mezulina packet of laws, Yelena Mezulina's infamous series of laws on these topics. But this is the domestic component. Internationally, we see Russia supporting xenophobic and traditional, so-called traditionalist elements in the West. And so I see these things merging. It's kind of this ideology they're promoting at home, they're trying to export abroad.
You see, I think a lot of that is highly instrumental. I mean, look, I agree that this is a regime which is clearly socially conservative, socially retrograde, and indeed deeply unpleasant in many of its basic impulses. And yes, they're also, let's use the W word, weaponizing that for suitable constituencies. But let's be perfectly honest, this is also a regime which is happy to provide aid, comfort, and sometimes practical support to movements like Occupy Wall Street when it's convenient for them. I mean, they did. I mean, if you look at the way RT elevated Occupy Wall Street, now it's not for a moment because the Occupy movement was sort of some kind of Russian puppet. They just thought, this is convenient. This is actually kind of, you know, ripping at elements of the Western system, so we'll support it. They support leftist groups as well, you know, Cinque Stelle in Italy, at the same time as supporting Lega Nord on the right. I mean, I think generally speaking,
the Soviet Union would support groups on the right as well sometimes when it suited their purpose. I don't think that negates
the
ideology.
Yeah, but if you're going to sort of say, aha, there is clearly an ideology as demonstrated by the people that they support outside the country, you can't then say, well, except, of course, for the ones that don't fit in with
well,
that.
Well, no, because the Soviet Union, I don't think any of us would disagree, had an ideology. And it certainly overtly supported left-wing groups abroad. Mm-hmm. But it also, when it suited its purposes, would support right-wing groups.
Sure, but we didn't use that as an index to say the Soviet Union had an ideology.
There was a canon, and it was expressly stated that this is the problem.
I mean, and I mean, look, in some ways, this is as much almost, shall I say, sort of political science theology than anything else, because actually it's a question of, well, what makes an ideology?
What makes an
where is the boundary? And obviously this is an entirely sort of subjective issue, but I think when it comes down to it, I still feel that this is something that is being, it is something that the Kremlin picks because it needs to have some kind of rationale. I mean, it has lost the technocratic imperative. It's lost the capacity to say, trust us because your life is getting better, and it will be even better next year, and your kids, whoa, they'll have a great life, and so forth.
No, it's saying trust us because we will provide you a bright, shining future in the Russian world where we're protecting the traditionalist values
West. You either have to be effective or moral, in effect. And what they're trying to say is, okay, we're not effective in the sense of precisely your life is actually getting harder, not better. But we are moral in the sense of we speak to certain values and they are your values too. So yes, I mean, it is certainly projecting itself as an ideological regime. It is using ideology as a way of essentially sort of trying to impose some degree of cultural hegemony. But I'm just not convinced that it actually believes those things.
Not bad for a guy with jet lag. Sean, your thoughts.
Well, I think that this conversation about whether there's an idea, I agree with a lot of what Mark is saying in terms of trying to pinpoint an ideology of the Putin regime, but I actually like to move away from Putin and the regime itself and recognize the fact that there's a Russian society out there. And a lot of this discussion about the traditional values, the, all of these laws, it's missing a societal component. Now, there are forces within Russian society that are highly conservative, one of which is factions within the church. Mm-hmm. And nobody really, we rarely talk about the presence of the Russian Orthodox Church in Russian society, except as some kind of tool of the Kremlin. And it's clear that they, you know, there is a relationship there. I mean, we can see this by the state handing over property back to the church. The struggle over St. Isaac's Cathedral in Petersburg is a perfect example of this. But there's a new book out that I just got in the mail a few days ago by a professor over at the Theological School, which is actually a couple of blocks from my house, called Holy Rus, The Rebirth of Orthodoxy in the New Russia. His name is John Burgess. And he spent a lot of time actually going around parishes in Russia, attending church services, talking to believers, talking to local priests. And what he's arguing is actually we're witnessing a process of re-Christianization within Russia. Now, I'm not going to say that this is – I don't know how widespread this is, and I haven't read – I've only browsed through the book, so I can't really comment on you know, the material in it. But it's clear, like, for example, take the domestic violence law. One of the pressure for this law came from the Orthodox Church and a very strange organization called the All Russian Parents Resistance. And it's hard to know what this organization is, but they're the ones that collected and in quotes collected 260,000 signatures, which honestly isn't enough to move legislation for anything anywhere, but in Russia apparently it did in this case. And if you look at their website, it's actually really interesting. Essentially what they're calling for, and I think this is what you'll find in the church as well amongst its more conservative parts, that they want they don't want any minimal juridical oversight over family relations. They want this to be handled within the family and ideally within under a patriarch, a father. If you look at some of the people who are behind these laws, like Mizulina is a perfect example, they also have connections with American evangelical groups. Every year for the last couple of years, they've been attending this World Congress of Families, which mm-hmm. is a collection of evangelical groups. There's been only a few articles, but there's been writings about the influence of American evangelical ideas on the Russian social values about homosexuality, trying to, you know, make abortion a political issue. So there's the point being is that there's something stirring within Russian society as well that I don't think we can totally say is some sort of instrumental outgrowth of the regime itself, but something that I think the way I see all of this is the attempt to establish Russian national identity in a post-Soviet frame.
Mm. Now, I'm glad you brought the church into the picture because I did want to bring we can't really have a discussion about the ideology of contemporary Russia without a discussion of the church. What about the church and this synchronicity with society that we see right now, Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually... I mean, what Sean said is absolutely right. We have to also look at it from below. And clearly, this would only work, whether we regard it as instrumental or not, if there was at least a certain fraction within society that was actually receptive or indeed calling for it. And we know that the church is not just simply a transmission belt of the Kremlin. I mean, one can even go back and look at the whole Pussy Riot business and the extent to which it is actually clear that it was the church
was
that pushed and that turned this into much bigger issue than the straight structures would have sort of instinctively have gone for. So, of course, there is this feedback mechanism that is taking place. Certain elements of the church that are also, you know, not only perhaps, shall we say, the more aggressive ones, but also whose interests, whose instincts fit most closely with the Kremlin's own interests. You know, there is clearly an alliance there. But even then, I mean, if going back to this point about sort of limitations, one of the things that is striking is, whereas on the one hand, you know, quite possibly there is a re-Christianization within Russia. That's not within my remit. I don't know. I'm willing to believe it. But on the other hand, I mean, actually, if one looks at the relationship of the Kremlin with Islam, if you look at actually how in Tatarstan, in the North Caucasus and so forth, I mean, actually, this is certainly not a regime which is in any way looking to sort of bring in Russification on in religious terms or whatever. I mean, again, in this case,
certainly not
regime
in the North Caucasus.
Pragmatism.
Certainly not in the North Caucasus, but to a greater extent in Tatarstan.
I don't think for no. I mean, I think they're very, very keen to actually sort of support what they think of as the sort of sane, moderate, reasonable, non-Wahhabi.
All the while Russifying.
Well, not in the sense. I mean, in a way, I think actually Tatarstan is quite a sort of a case in which actually you have a very, very pragmatic policy from the Kremlin, one that actually, you know, realizes that this is probably one of the clear test cases. If it actually wanted to impose the same thing, I mean, obviously the you know, federal laws are federal laws. But you might say the extent to which it actually wants to push an ideology, a religious and a values-based agenda on Tatarstan against the interests of, you know, sort of a local elite that is, you know, clearly very sort of very concerned about not alienating Islam, because that's exactly what they feel would actually generate a real insurgency there as well, which is clearly one of the Kremlin's nightmares. I think we see ideology taking second place to pragmatic statecraft.
Yeah, may I say something
ahead,
about
yeah.
that? Yeah, this has been, you know, Russia, as we know, has been a multi-confessional society for a very long time. And various governments, Tsarist, Soviet, have had various policies on how to manage the other faiths. You know, sometimes they were more forceful in terms of Christianizing or suppressing, you know, non-Orthodox religions, particularly if they're small sects. I mean, you know, sectarianism in Russian society religious sectarianism has always been, there's a long history of repression. But in terms of the Muslim population, I mean, if you consider how the Tsarist government dealt with Islam, it was mostly loyalty to the center, but local regulation by the religious hierarchy. Right. It was this pragmatic relationship to basically secure political loyalty of the elites, but they are allowed to adjudicate within certain reason their constituents and their congregations. And here I think we see something similar. And I would go along with what Mark says, that there is a pragmatism in dealing with non-Orthodox faith, even though you have a seemingly resurgence of, at least in some form of orthodoxy or orthodox belief in traditional values and stuff. But their problem is, of course, when those non-orthodox faiths go to extreme places, then it becomes a problem.
Mm. Now, maybe I talk to my Tatar colleagues a bit too much, but I see a bit more Russification in Tatarstan than I don't want to go down a rabbit hole here.
But what is Russification?
Well, mostly it's a lot of it's about the language, but it's also people would say it's questionable criminal cases for Wahhabism against those who are not, in fact, associated with Wahhabism in any ways. It's repression of religious communities in Tatarstan as well. And it's also a lot about the language issue, and it's also a lot about Orthodox education in public schools.
Yeah,
which
well,
really
this is an
sticks.
Issue.
This is a big issue.
Yeah.
So I talk to my Tatar colleagues about this a lot, and they see and I see a lot more Russification going on in Tatarstan, but I don't think. I mean, you could make this work in terms of the traditional values by bringing in the traditional Islamist values as well, as long as they are loyal to the state. Mark, I wanted to bring you in here because I know you love to talk about Nicholas the First. It's one of your favorite topics. It's up there with the mafia and spies. So to me, in a lot of ways, this does hark back to the orthodoxy, autocracy, and nationality of Nicholas the First. That wasn't a fully baked ideology either. But it was, correct me if I'm wrong, Sean, you're the historian, the first real like ideological formulation by a Russian ruler, pre-revolutionary. But what do you think we're seeing a return? Is it an attempt to resurrect that?
Quite possibly. But if so, once again, it's a regime that is choosing to reinterpret for its own convenience. I mean, the interesting thing about Nicholas I is that, you know, he was the Tsar who was not meant to be the Tsar. He was the younger son. Therefore, he was intended to basically go into the military, the sort of the other classic sort of route. Right. And yet, when he did end up becoming Tsar, you know, he brought with him that military sense, you know, and in many ways it was very limiting. I mean, no one would say that Tsar Nicholas I was a deep or broad thinker. But nonetheless, one of the key things about him was precisely his sense that exactly there was a duty that went both ways. You know, that linked in with this whole notion is the fact of this is also the Tsar who was clearly deeply perturbed about corruption within the elite. A Tsar who actually sort of regarded, and I don't just think this was just simply self-serving sort of rationalization, but actually that, you know, he had huge privileges as Tsar, but as such he had huge responsibilities. Now, I have to say that I don't really see in Putin and in Putin's inner circle that sense of an ascetic devotion to the nation, and let alone a sense of a willingness to actually come to terms with the corruption at the heart of the system.
So you're saying Nicholas believed the hype and Putin doesn't?
Exactly. I mean, I think this is it. It's actually, it is Tsar Nicholas I light. It is that notion, but sort of carefully sort of packaged so that, it provides some grand historical rationale for Putin. And, you know, Putin thinks of history and reads history and wants to see how he's written in the history books. And therefore, I think, sort of consciously sort of plays these roles sometimes, but without actually accepting the internal disciplines that would involve.
I mean, I see two other parallels with Nicholas the First, the aversion to revolution, of course, coming to the throne as the Decemberist uprising was. But also, I see, bear in mind that Nicholas the First was, you know, was the Tsar during the Holy Alliance. Essentially, this notion that Russia is the Russian Empire is the policeman of traditional values in Europe, so to speak. I mean, one of my favorite taglines is Putin wants to party like it's 1815. I've said this over and over and over again and overused that headline to death. But I say it because I really do believe there is some kind of parallel here. Sean, you're the historian. What do you think?
Well, if we're going to talk about some, you know, redux of an official nationality, what does it compose of? What are its three pillars, if we want to mimic it? And I think what I've identified it as those possibilities are sovereignty, patriotism, and orthodoxy. Mm-hmm. And you can see these emerging out of the rhetoric of the government. And granted, let's put aside the fact that they actually, you know, hold themselves. I think these three things are for others, not necessarily for themselves. But, you know, sovereignty has been part of the political discourse in Russia since the early 2000s. Patriotism has been revived through the creation and utilization of the World War II memory and myth and mythology. And here we, you know, some of the things we've been talking today, the return of the Orthodox Church as some pillar or attempting to be reassert itself as a pillar within Russian society. And I think that we can see this quite, you know, these three things quite active within mm-hmm. Russian society. And it's interesting because, again, I go back to one of my big things, and that is, you know, if we think about what was the role of official nationality in Nicholas I, on the one hand, it was to provide some sort of rationale for exactly what you said, this, you know, Nicholas I as a gendarme of Europe, putting down destabilizing revolutions, particularly against other absolutist or autocratic states, being to build some sort of nationalism to capitalize on the general patriotism that came after the defeat of Napoleon, and to institutionalize that, but also to provide an ideology for the education system, which of course was for the most part the Russian elite and the nobility, some of which were the ones that actually rose against him. Right. So this is a way to put down revolutionary enlightenment ideas within amongst the Russian elite, too, as well. But for my thing is, what role is this playing for? Why would the Russian government want to put forward an ideology at this point? And I go back to one of the things that I've been thinking about a lot, and I mentioned it briefly a few minutes ago, is what is the character of Russian national identity today? it's especially if we follow what Kirill has put forward, Kirill Korbin's put forward, the fact that we are no longer in a post-Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. We're something else. And that question of what is that something else is one that needs to be answered. Because, you know, if we think about Putin's rule in the last 17 years as restoration, right? The restoration of Russia. We have Russia's economic restoration. We have Russia's global positioning, geopolitical restoration. We have some, to some, you know, societal restoration. And now we have to say, okay, so what is the culture? What is the values? What is the identity for the new Russian person? Mm-hmm. And I think that this process is more speaking to that rather than necessarily, you know, it's connected to projecting power abroad. I don't want to minimize that, but I think it's part of a more gradual developing historical process that's necessary after revolutions. Mm. And I think we're finally seeing the crystallization of something.
I mean, I would add a couple of things to you. You say sovereignty, patriotism, and orthodoxy. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, I would substitute the autocracy, but something else I would add in there is empire. Empire, and that meaning the whole concept of the Russian world, which I think is a component of this ideology that we haven't, or this incipient ideology, or this non-ideology, depending on your perspective, that we haven't touched upon yet. But what about the concept of the Russian world?
I find that the trouble is the Russian world is something that seems to be switched on and off with great ease. It periodically just disappears from discourse, and certainly sort of it is only when it is convenient that it really becomes an issue. And again, I mean, so if we link it back to Nicholas I, I mean, who, of course, yes, he was against revolutions, but very few czars, it has to be said, are pro. And it's worth mentioning, I mean, you know, Nicholas I was also the person who sort of first ordered serious investigation into the idea of emancipating the serfs. And he backed away from that because he thought, and in hindsight, entirely rightly, that it would be a massively destabilizing, even if economically that was the way to go, politically he regarded it as destabilizing. So, I mean, obviously there are parallels mm-hmm. with Putin, just as one could say, well, Nicholas's dependence upon Baltic German aristocrats, whom he thought as being more honest and efficient than the Russians, kind of maps over to sort of Putin's belief that by basically hiring Czechists, somehow you get the new nobility. But look, if we look at this notion of him as the sort of the creator, you know, the upholder of traditional regimes, one has to ask how that maps across to a regime assiduously supporting populists, assiduously seeking to actually disrupt the system. I mean, in a way, what Putin is trying to do is, if Nicholas I was about reinstituting early 19th century policies, Putin is about reinstituting early 19th century policies. But that is actually a very revolutionary act in the context of the
early 21st century. It all depends on the context of the world we're working in. We're not working in... Putin would like to return us to that world. To do so, he has to uproot this world.
True, but this is it. I mean, I think... But, you know, whereas Nicholas was holding on to something, I think there is a big difference. Mm. But so what it really comes back to is... And again, so I'll pick up on something that Sean was saying is, you know, is this an ideology? Because an ideology carries with it... It has a certain universality. It's always difficult to have an ideology that is also country-specific. You know, mm-hmm. Part of the idea is that it is an idea. And instead, I definitely would agree with Sean, this is actually more about the creation of a vision of a Russia. Mm-hmm. You know, there has been no consensus, or rather there have been sort of temporary consensuses, but none of them have proved satisfactory and lasting. And I think this is part of sort of Putin's self-image of himself as the sort of the new regatherer of the Russian lands mm-hmm. is actually precisely is he's the man who is going to bring some kind of a vision to Russia, which will be a cohering force. It doesn't mean to say that everyone will, you know, it's not like Soviet ideology or whatever, where sort of everyone has to be marching in lockstep. But the idea of creating some kind of sense of what is Russia mm-hmm. And that is it's not something that necessarily kind of goes down into the micro scale. again, unlike an ideology. It is, I think, by definition, a big picture notion.
Although he has tried to internationalize this by saying that these are European values, Europe's just abandoned them.
Yeah, but I'm
they abandoned
not,
them
I'm
in
not
the 19th century,
how
but
far
never
that's,
mind. Right?
That's just because it's a good
it's a
instrument.
Nice tagline.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, again, I mean, I think there are things that are, and you know, and we're guessing, we're trying to crawl into that deep dark cavern of his brain. But you know, I think that, you know, he knows what is a good line. And sometimes he
sure
you know,
does, yeah.
You know, and sometimes he presents Russia as the defender of Christendom against sort of Islam and non-Christian forces. Sometimes it's about traditional values being protected, and sometimes it's actually about sort of Russia being a dynamic liberal society. I mean,
it's been a long time since we heard that one.
Well, dynamic,
yes,
we do
liberal
still
now.
Have or whatever. I mean, this is it. I think, you know, in terms of external politics, this is a very opportunistic angle because I don't think he ultimately cares. He doesn't care what outsiders think, except insofar as it's useful to him. I think he does care what Russians think about Russia. Mm.
I mean, one thing I've noticed in watching Russian TV, and you got to go have to see your shrink after you watch Kislyov every week, but I nevertheless do it. But a distinctive shift. The enemy, of course, is not the United States anymore. It is global liberalism. It's global liberalism. Macron was derided as being the French candidate, Emmanuel Macron, who's now the standard bearer of French liberalism, was decried as being the hand-picked candidate of the global banking elite supported by the Americans, supported by a wealthy gay lobby. He actually used that phrase. So you see this shift in the propaganda, which tends to me to suggest this is where the Kremlin's thinking right now. Before we shift into the next section, there is one thing I definitely wanted to talk about before we shift, because I know Mark and I probably disagree about this, and that is not sure where you are on this, Sean, but the influence of white emigre thinkers like Ivan Illin. I mean, it's you can kind of map out the influence of Illin on Putin's thinking. I mean, he has returned his remains to Russia and had him buried there. He lays flowers on his grave every year. He's bought the archive, had the archive purchased from the United States and returned to Russia. There's a reading group in the Kremlin that reads Illin, right? And if you look at Illin's thinking, you know, he talks about the need for a single paternalistic leader who controls all the branches of government. Legislative, judicial, you have elections that are just shows. Sound familiar, right? That Russia is this pure, innocent state that's corrupted by Western decadence. I know you are skeptical of the influence of Ivan Illin on the Kremlin elite. Let's hear it.
Well, I think two things. I mean, one is in terms of the specifics. Yes, of course. I mean, there has been this rediscovery of Illin. I'm not quite convinced about this reading group in the Kremlin notion. I mean, I know it's a sort of, Illin was on a sort of list of books that certainly sort of Russian governors were encouraged to read. But along with people like Berdyaev, who are even less right. sort of in tune
and
with
Putin
the
tends to quote Illin.
He's
very
quoted
important.
Him about five or six times. Now, okay, maybe
very important
ones.
Points.
well, yes, but I mean, I think, but anyway, and I think the thing is, though, again, it goes back to my point about sort of cherry picking and the creation of politically useful ones. Because yes, those points you made about Illin were all true, and indeed, Illin was also someone who, you know, absolutely did not believe that Ukraine had any kind of independent role.
There's no such
part,
thing as Ukraine,
precisely,
according to Illin.
But
and Ukraine's not a real country, mm-hmm. according to Putin.
Exactly, but nonetheless. You might say, if you think of the three basic pillars of Illin's thinking, one of them, a crucial one, is legal consciousness. Mm-hmm. He was absolutely committed to the idea that the state, and when you say state, means top to bottom, or more to the point, bottom to top, actually had to be informed by a very, very powerful legal consciousness, and in other words, had to follow the law.
Dictatorship of the law.
Yeah.
Right?
And
well, I'm giving you Putin's words.
But the point, but again, we come back to this thing of fine, so as an instrumental truth, but, you know, we can't for a moment suggests that Putin Russia's believes
a legal state. No,
exactly, that the laws are anything other than just simply a totally mutable instrument of state power and the enrichment
no,
of his cronies.
No, and nor could we think that the Soviet Politburo circa Brezhnev actually believed in socialism. So, I mean, there's going to be hypocrisy here.
True, but you might say
the implementation
that was
of any ideology.
But that was a sort of a, I mean, obviously quite when it started was very early, but, you know, this is about the sort of the decay. Mm-hmm. There was an ideology. There was a codified ideology that was meant to be the foundational element on which this whole state was built. And yes, over time, increasingly, you had corruption and cynicism and careerism. So that absolutely by the end, I mean, you know, in a way, Gorbachev was the last believer. but the thing about Ilyin is exactly, it's actually, if we do decide that, in fact, this is sort of a central part, I think it actually says much more about the extent to which it is convenient to find an ideological, you know, and indeed a pre-Soviet ideological voice that is saying things that actually chime with the instincts, the gut sense of Putin of what kind of a Russia he wants. But again, at the same time, they will only pick and follow the bits that are convenient for that.
Sean, your thoughts?
Because just
on
actually, oh, one thought. I mean, and I think the trouble is because we, let's be honest, we none of us really know.
No, of course we don't know.
So I think there is always this desperate
improving
search
influence is hard. I mean, yeah, it's very
but
hard.
But there's
to
always this
influence.
Quest for if only we can find. There is a sense almost if we can find this key. I mean, like for some instance, this ridiculous notion that Dugin represents a sort of Rasputin of the Kremlin. And so, but, you know, we see this bubbling up. You know, different figures arise and people say, at last, we found. Because what we want
Putin's
is a predictive
brain.
Instrument. and unfortunately, I think the thing is, there is no such thing because there is no Bible of Putinism.
So it's this a la carte ideology, if you will.
And
it's a salad bar.
It's evolving and exactly.
It's not fully baked, but I'm beginning to see contours of it coming into focus, and that's why I wanted to do this topic. Sean, I wanted to hear your thoughts on Ilyin.
I can't speak to Ilyin because I haven't read enough to really say anything intelligent about it, but I do want to comment on the phenomenon of the whites.
Okay.
Because this is actually really interesting, especially considering
the 17th revolution.
The revolution. Yeah, and what we have seen is this, not just the repatriation of whites, a general reevaluation of the white armies, attempt to a reconciliation. In fact, a lot of people have been wondering, so what is the Kremlin going to do about the centennial of the Russian Revolution? And from what has been made public is that it's supposed to be about reconciliation.
Yes, but the reconciliation in this context means really the elevation of the whites.
Well, of course.
Because I believe Putin's not a red. Putin's a white.
No, not at all.
He's a white.
But I think this is very important if we're speaking about, you know, ideological issues in the broadest sense. One of the things that's interesting about Putin's Russia is how it understands history. And what the goal is, I think, one of the goals with the repatriation of whites and the bringing them up and recognizing them and all of, you know, some sort of church recognition, et cetera, publishing their writings, et cetera, is about smoothing out the fractures of Russian history.
Mm-hmm.
And putting the state as the eternal presence.
And the ultimate arbiter.
Yeah, the state is the eternal historical line. The Russian state has been there, always been there. Therefore, the Soviet state is the inheritor of the imperial state, which is the inheritor of the Muscovite state down the line. And today's Russian state is the inheritor of those previous states. If we consider, like, okay, if Putin is against revolution, you know, or particular types of revolution, the idea is to smooth out those, you know, the very tumultuous 100+ years of Russian history, which has been revolutions one mm-hmm. after the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 1905, 1917, 1991.
Yeah. No, I agree with you that is going to be the mood music of the commemorations mm-hmm. of the 1917 anniversary. I think the subtext is going to be the elevation of the whites. Because if Putin were alive in 1918, he would have been a white.
he's a white, and he's a white. And what's interesting too is that a lot of Russian immigrants of the whites are also quite have an affinity for Putin.
Yes, they do. Yeah,
right. So it's and speaking about the Russian world, which I think is actually one of the weakest components. I am with Mark on this, but in this sense. Stretching back and tapping into the traditions of these white emigres from the early part of the 20th century, you do see an affinity.
Mm-hmm, certainly. Mark?
Yeah, I mean, I would very much actually agree with both of you. And I think when you said Putin is a white, I think that, you know, that's it spot on. In some ways, Putin is a 21st century czarist in a, you know, a Russia without a czar. Now, just as czarist Russia didn't really have an ideology. I mean, yes, you have people like Nicholas the First and, you know, Alexander the Third, sort of trying to find more of a way of framing it, but it never really took, never really became foundational. But what there was absolutely this kind of this continuity of vision of what Russia was, you know, which also fits in with what Sean was saying about precisely, you know, this continuity of state. And I think that's this kind of the tradition he's trying to place himself in. His issue is precisely is how to get the Russian people to follow him there.
And that's a good note to close out the first section. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion and shift gears somewhat and look at 10 years of Ramzan Kadyrov and the influence the mercurial Chechen leader has had on Russian politics. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. Joining me here in the studio is co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog and host of the SRB podcast. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rferl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Хорошо, что Россия не отпустила Чеченскую
республику. Так стабильно ситуация, порядок.
Сейчас, на сегодняшний день, у нас есть один лидер. Вот,
Путин мой кумир. Мой кумир Путин. Я его люблю. Я его уважаю.
Well, it's hard to believe that it's only been 10 years. But a decade ago this week, Vladimir Putin appointed a then 30-year-old Ramzan Kadyrov as Chechnya's leader. When Putin named Kadyrov on February 15, 2006, the idea was simple. Put a loyal warlord in charge and give him a green light to kill and steal as much as he wants in exchange for taming the rest of North Caucasus Republic and beating it into submission. But I argued this week on the Daily Vertical that a decade of Kadyrov's rule has resulted less in the Putinization of Chechnya than in the Kadyrovization of Russia, with Putin embracing things like a cult of personality, Puritan religious values, and a Praetorian Guard. Mark, I know you think I overstated my case a bit, and perhaps I did, but it was fun. What would you say Kadyrov's influence on the Russian body politic has been over this past decade?
Yeah, I mean, well, I obviously agree that there hasn't been a Putinization of Chechnya.
There's been a Kadyrovization of Chechnya.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that stretched. I mean, actually, because, I mean, by contrast, Putin's Russia is looking pretty good. There is still, especially in the print and online media, quite considerable room for criticism. Critics of the regime are likely to be hounded by the regime, which is terrible, but not grabbed by masked men for their bodies to appear 3 weeks later in a ditch covered in electrical burns. Even the business of the National Guard, compared with Kadyrov's Kadyrovtsi. The Kadyrovtsi swear an oath to Kadyrov as a person. Now, although the National Guard are in the hands of Zolotov, whom you presume to be a loyal Putin man, but, you know, individual National Guardsmen are... they swear an oath to the state. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, that there is a difference. So where do I feel that the Chechnya fits in? I mean, I think of it as it is a diseased organ leaching toxins into the rest of the body politic. Not necessarily fatal.
Necessarily not fatal.
Exactly. No, exactly. And so far, you know, the patient has not been willing to go under the knife. has been too afraid of the implications of an amputation. But that is, I think, where it fits at the moment. I mean, it is clearly a problem for Putin, not least because of the economic burdens. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one of the reasons for the sort of the face-off we had last year, when Kadyrov sort of floated the idea, oh, maybe I'm tired of being boss of Chechnya. Maybe the Kremlin should appoint someone else, which was a
bluff.
Exactly. It was a complete. If you think you've got someone else who could take my place, by all means, give it a whirl. Mm. And what happened was the Kremlin backed down, and attempts to cut the share of the quantity of subsidy that went to Chechnya at a time when, after all, there were so many other demands to Crimea and so forth, had to be reversed. So basically, Chechnya is still being subsidized fully, and therefore everyone else is having to pay for it.
Sean, your thoughts on 10 years of Ramzan?
Well, I don't see the
Kadyrovization.
Kadyrovization of Russia. I mean, particularly, the cult of personality. You don't need to go to Chechnya to find roots for that in Russian society. But Chechnya does seem to be a problem that is mostly contained for the most part. Contained mostly because you have a brutal, warlord that's ruling over it that people have to make personal fealty to. But it's also, I think Mark's analogy to a disease or a diseased organ is probably an interesting one to think about, because it can't let it go, right? If it cuts it loose, then the problems might actually come, and you have to keep supplying it with blood to prevent it from going into complete collapse. So it's a problem for this, and I think of all of the Russian regions, I think Chechnya and perhaps even Dagestan to some extent remain the most volatile, in terms of being a problem for the federal system.
Mark, I want to push on this diseased organ bit. Are we talking about Kadyrov or Chechnya?
Well, I think at the moment it's very difficult to actually detach the two, because one thing that has happened is precisely that Kadyrov truly has made Chechnya a personal fiefdom, essentially a personal property. I mean, this is the bizarre thing. In the name of fighting Chechen independence, they have created a Chechnya
which is
more
independent than Chechnya for
centuries, and one that is able to get Moscow to pay for itself. I mean, on one level, it's actually quite brilliant, except that the Russians have basically did it to themselves. I think that at the moment, of course, there are Chechens who are not Kadyrov fans, but no one who would sort of dare say so. And the interesting thing is, I don't think that the Russians are in a position at the moment to imagine that. I mean, this is the thing. One of my fond imaginings is precisely the day when they decide, they summon Kadyrov to give him yet another medal. They found the one that he hasn't had yet. Shot putter third class or something. And in fact, they arrest him in instead. But the point is, I mean, when I talk to people within the sort of Russian realms of that kind of thing, they all seem to feel that basically they're stuck with Kadyrov. That without Kadyrov, you're basically heading towards a third Chechen war, which would be, for all kinds of reasons, inconceivable at the moment. So, I think in a way, so long as Moscow thinks Kadyrov equals Chechnya, Chechnya equals Kadyrov, in some ways it doesn't matter what the rest of us
right.
think.
Can I ask
a question of Mark? Because I don't know the history of Chechnya very well, but what was the situation in Chechnya in the 70s?
I mean, essentially, it was... I'm inclined to say the situation was a little bit like Georgia, obviously on a much smaller scale, in that all the forms of compliance, while gleefully working out how it could screw Moscow for every ruble it possibly could, and yet at the same time, when it comes down to it, an awareness that Moscow always could reach in and deal with something. So there was a sort of a Cold War, shall we say?
Mm-hmm. But it wasn't. In terms of the levels of for the dangers for violence. No. And, yeah,
I knew people in Moscow who traded their apartments, like in the '70s and eighties, to live in Chechnya for the climate, and because it was a nice, laid back lifestyle compared to living in Moscow. And they, you know, of course, I met one of these guys who was trying to get his papers to come back to Moscow in the '90s, and having a hard time of it. Because he was propisant in Chechnya, and so no, I imagine it kind of almost idyllic is a hard word to, but yeah, I think Georgia is probably the best.
And interestingly, like Georgia, in some ways, the whole kind of bandit tradition, which now you know is a central element to sort of both the struggle against the Russians by the rebels, but also to an extent also sort of Kadyrov and his Kadyrovtsi, actually had. Pretty much disappeared in the '70s. Yes, you had a few people, but on the whole, it had become folklore.
Right.
That thing that happens to sort of bloody things, sort of, they become touristified. You know, so that actually, you know, you had sort of concepts like kidnapping of brides and that kind of thing, which was it was for the films, it was for the stories, and it was for kind of tales of my grandfather. Mm-hmm. Rather than anything that really happened, they more or less reinvented the proud, lonely Chechen abrek, you know, sort of Robin Hood bandit figure, which basically had disappeared in real terms in the '70s.
Mark, your fantasy about Kadyrov getting called to the Kremlin for another medal, I couldn't help but think of the scene in Goodfellas when Tommy thinks he's being taken to become a made man, when in fact he's being taken to get whacked. You know the scene I'm referring to. It's a great scene, but you seem to be skeptical of the allowing that the Kremlin believes that removing Kadyrov would be incredibly destabilizing. I know you're skeptical of that notion.
Well, I think again there is this extent to which actually the Russians are victims of their own literature. they have this notion, you know, again through the 19th century works of the Chechen as this extraordinary, proud, formidable individual who would do anything to redeem his word, and so forth. Well, actually, I mean, if you think about it, you know, the core of the Kadyrovtsi was ex-rebels who decided actually it was much more convenient to come in from the hills and flip. So, you know, in a way, it's based on people who had essentially forsworn one cause for another. And, okay, in some cases for reasons, you know, maybe they were nationalists who were horrified by the sort of increasing influence of jihad within. But you know, a lot of them, it was just convenience, or else they were actually caught and they were given a choice.
Right.
So I think in those circumstances, we shouldn't actually assume that the Chechens are that much less willing to sort of change sides at the right point. But again, I think it's for the Russians, the Chechen War particularly was a very traumatic experience. And, you know, the thought of having to do it all over again, particularly now when Kadyrov has built up a sort of a military force that is, you know, relatively formidable. And they're also stuck in Syria and they're stuck in the Donbass and so forth. They haven't got a lot of spare troops. To start throwing people into the North Caucasus, it would be the National Guard, but it would also have to be conscripts. And, you know, again, if we're thinking of the political dimension, you know, Russians at the moment are very keen on the importance of defending the fatherland until it means that your boy is coming home in a zinc box.
But you think if they did decide to do this, they could do it, and they wouldn't be facing their worst nightmare.
It's a toy cost like everything. But I mean, if they took Kadyrov neatly in Moscow, if they immediately rolled out some, you know, this is the person who's going to be taking over, who probably in the first instance will be a Russian. But if they made it clear that basically the rest of the elite would not immediately suffer, I mean, the problem is this: ideally, they want to be able to cut the money they spend on Chechnya and get rid of Kadyrov. They can't do that.
You can't do both. Yeah.
You know, they would have to, as the price for getting rid of Kadyrov and doing it smoothly, is to essentially promise the same level of... Because obviously the subsidies are embezzled on an industrial scale.
Yeah.
So they would have to be willing to do that. Now, I think it's a suitable investment because you're going to be paying that subsidy anyway with Kadyrov there. get rid of Kadyrov and then maybe move into a position where you can slowly house train Chechnya over time. But I think at the moment, as I said, until Putin gives me a ring and asks me what I think, I don't believe that there's any real appetite.
So he's 10 years of Kadyrov, he's here to stay.
So long as Putin is in the Kremlin, certainly, unless and until, you know, someday someone might get through. I mean, there are still occasional terrorist attacks in Chechnya.
And as long as he stays, does this diseased organ continue to infect the Russian body politic? So we could see the Kadyrovization of Russia, if you will, if this continues.
Well, I think it's more that what we could see is the Kadyrovization of the rest of the North Caucasus. Because this is the thing. I mean, at the moment, you know, yes, Chechnya is this haven of brutally enforced calm in a region which is actually becoming increasingly volatile. Now, and the Russians clearly do not have an answer. They cycle through different things. You know, should they throw a bit more money, which tends to get stolen? Should they instead sort of appoint some sort of, you know, tough, hardline individual? I mean, they're sort of currently toying with bringing in a National Guard general and so forth. You know, they clearly haven't had an answer. Now the risk is either they end up thinking the only way we can deal with this is to basically have some more Kadyrovs. I don't think they're quite at that stage. But also there's Kadyrov himself with his periodic attempts at empire building.
Oh, God, let him build an empire. Good God.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, he has. He has made it clear that,
yeah,
you know,
no, I
once
know.
Upon a time, Ingushetia and Chechnya were one unit, and he thinks we're
no,
one.
No, I know he wants that. I don't know if they're toying with giving him the green light on that. That's...
Well, no, but the point is, the more he pushes, and, you know, periodically he does, then the more chance there is for something dangerously explosive to happen. So, I mean, I think in some ways what we're seeing is, if not a Kadyrovization, it is a Chechenization of the rest of the North Caucasus. The question is, do the Russians have the capacity or the appetite to take the Kadyrov option again in response? And if they don't, what else can they offer?
All right. Well, on that note, we shall wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me here in the studio has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a senior research fellow at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, a visiting fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. And joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies, author of Sean's Russia blog, and host of the SRB podcast. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.